Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. We spend a lot of time talking about how important it is to take care of your mental health. Therapy is an excellent way to do that. BetterHelp is an affordable mental health care option that fits right into your busy schedule. Just answer a few quick questions about your needs and preferences, and BetterHelp will match you with one of the thousands of experienced mental health professionals in their network. You can talk to your therapist over text, chat, phone, or video. You get to pick what works best for you, your comfort, and your schedule. If you feel like your therapist isn't the right fit, BetterHelp makes it easy to switch to someone new at no additional cost. So give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. BetterHelp is offering our listeners 10% off their first month of therapy. Just go to betterhelp.com/musicspeaks to get started. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/musicspeaks to get 10% off your first month of therapy.
Hey guys, we wanted to take a quick minute to tell you about our recent partnership with the Amazing Bones Coffee Company.
Let's face it, you're probably sick and tired of drinking that old plain Jane coffee brand every morning. Well, fret not, dear listener. Bones Coffee is here to kick your taste buds into high gear.
Bones Coffee has a wide variety of flavors to choose from, including maple bacon, peaches and spring, island grog, and my personal favorite, chocolate raspberry.
Once you become hooked on the coffee, you'll be excited to learn that they have plenty of merch options to choose from as well. T-shirts, mugs, tote bags, the list goes on.
You can buy their coffee in whole bean, ground, and even evil single serve options.
Guys, we wouldn't lie to you. This coffee is great, and we know that you're going to love it too, which is why we have partnered up with Bones Coffee, and now our listeners have an exclusive discount code.
Make sure to use the code MUSICSPEAKS at checkout for 10% off your order.
That's right, James. Go to bonescoffee.com to kickstart your new coffee addiction and use the code MUSICSPEAKS for 10% off today. If you're anything like me, free time is limited. So things like yard work are just not doable. And if you're also like me, you don't even own a lawnmower. That is why All Above Landscaping is the right choice. All Above includes a variety of options when it comes to your landscaping needs, including lawn installation, design, irrigation, debris removal, maintenance, and much more. If you're in the city of Sumter and you're looking for reliable service at a friendly price, give All Above Landscaping a call today. It's 803-464-7414. Mention that you heard this ad on this podcast and you'll get a special discount on your first service. Again, that's 803-464-7414. Call All Above Landscaping today. Like so many of you, we battle depression through life's ups and downs.
Music has always been the one thing we could rely on to get us through the tough times we all face.
Follow us on our journey as we discuss the healing power of music, share our stories through songs and lyrics,
interview musicians and other artists,
break down genres,
deep dive into band biographies,
and much, much more.
This is the Woodward Fail
Music Speaks podcast
with Blake Mosley,
James Cox,
and Amanda Dolan.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Woodward Fail Music Speaks podcast. This is your handicapped host, James Cox, and I'm back with you for another awesome interview. And I think by the end of this interview, me and Dave will become best friends, hopefully.
100%.
Maybe. 100%. Yep. Oh, see, we're already the best friends. How about that?
We're gonna start a business together and maybe join a band and the whole thing, yeah.
Well, something about you okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm interviewing Dave Perry. He is the drummer for the band Raw.
Correct.
R-A, which is awesome. I loved Raw back in the heyday, you know, and I still do.
Yeah.
And you are the drum tech for Nothing More, right?
Yes, yes.
And we're going to talk about that too. And cool. You have a band called Fear of Water.
That is also correct.
And I am also afraid of water. Where did that name come from? Are you like it could be? I can't swim worth a lick. You know, I used to swim, but something happened in the water, and I'm like, oh, so where did the fear water come from?
Understood. So it's not about an actual fear of water. It's actually a reference to it's kind of a creative nod to the fact that humans are comprised of, you know, about 80% water. And I've been, you know, making music under the name Fear of Water basically since I was in high school. And one of the like guiding factors of my writing process and like how I was using music to process emotions and just have this cathartic experience I was very overwhelmed by this dominant force of like cliques and like people feeling the need to like have their tribe and like all look the same, and like there's a pretty well defined and agreed upon thing of like what's cool and what's not and what's fashionable and what's not and what's hot and what's not. And I think in the process of a lot of people pursuing achieving that, being the most mainstream, the most accepted, that they completely turn their backs on who they really are, and, you know, metaphorically speaking, like their water, like what they're actually comprised of in the name of being accepted or being part of a community. And I'm not saying that I'm above that or I'm immune to that, but just have been constantly aware of that struggle. And it's really sad to see. Sometimes you get to know some people on a deeper level and you learn this like beautiful truth about them that they hide from the world because they have a fear of being rejected, or that their significant other won't accept them for this, or they're, you know, they're just extremely introverted or whatever. And I think that that's a very sad part of Western civilization, is this like, we don't encourage everyone to truly be themselves. And then by being yourself, you know, you'll find your tribe that way, instead of being like, oh, I desire to be a part of this group, so I'm going to change who I am and repress these like key parts of me in an attempt to be accepted. So it's really that fear of water is really about that fear of individuality, fear of being rejected by society in the name of being yourself.
Yeah, sometimes it's very, very hard to find a true calling, you know, true friends and family, you know.
Yeah, dude.
Because sometimes, most times, those friends aren't your friends, you know, anymore, and they'll, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's it's a huge part of the like human experience. Again, certainly in Western civilization, and a lot of our identity gets tied up in that, you know, the size of my friend group or the whatever social currency of those people defines my social currency. And I get it. Like we're kind of like conditioned to be put into that system, starting with school. And then you come out of school into the real world, you know, thoroughly trained to be like, cool, I need to replicate this model at college and in my whatever fraternity or organizations that I join or what job I get. And it's like, it's very toxic, and it's fortunate for better or for worse. Like there's pros and cons of this, but like as life has gone on, I have started my own business and, you know, for the most part, make music by myself. So I like really have removed even the opportunity to dilute myself and adhere to what social norms are, because I've isolated myself in that way as well. Yeah, it's interesting, man. Like I think you kind of need to do that, or a lot of people would benefit from removing yourself, even if it's just like unplugging from social media for a while, or like go camping for a whole week, or it's just like remove yourself from the normal day-to-day grind and get in touch with who you are, embrace your weirdness, whatever. Like life is too short to not be yourself.
See, that's it. Yeah, because I had to delete my whole Facebook like twice, you know, really? Just to get back to. Oh yeah, you know, because with me it's kind of like a I guess yin and yang, you know. Yeah, social media is good, but yeah, social media is also bad for you because of your mental health and everything.
Yeah,
and dude, I suffer with depression, and I just got really out of it, so I had to delete my account for twice, you know, twice before. And yep. I felt like wonderful when I came back on. So
good.
Of course,
I'm glad that you took that break. That's really important.
Yes, absolutely. For your mental health and your, you know, conscious awareness, you know, too. So
I can't imagine what kids are going through with social media. Like that horrifies me to know that, like, you know, I wasn't bullied. I've always been like a very large person, so the big dudes tend not to get picked on. But I saw plenty of bullying. But the thing is that when I went to school, bullying pretty much stopped at school, which is still, you know, it sucks, but it like 8-hour chunk of your life. And now it like follows you everywhere. If you have a phone in your, you have social media, and obviously that extends beyond school, but it's just like when you grow up, my heart breaks for these kids who grow up where social media is just the norm, and it's just, it is the way that we communicate, and it's an extension of your personality. And that probably even further exacerbates this, the fear of water, complex that I'm talking about. We're like, you had to worry about how you look and how you sound and who you hang out with at school and the physical location. Now you have to worry about it all the fucking time.
Especially who you listen to when you were growing up. Because if you listen to country, you're automatically, exiled by the metalheads and the, country and everything. Man, I love country. Country is my favorite genre. What's yours? Has it always been rock and metal?
It's definitely not been metal. That's been more of an acquired taste. I mean, I love metal now, but like early on, so I had two younger brothers, I'm the youngest. I had two older brothers. And I think it's pretty common in that kind of scenario is that I inherited music from my brothers, and so oldest brother's 4 years older than me. So like I'm technically a child of that, born in the 80s, was like in my childhood in the 90s. And I've kind of in a sweet spot of like inheriting all of this grunge music a little bit after its prime. It's crazy is that actually, I believe today is the anniversary of Kurt Cobain's suicide. And I vividly, vividly remember exactly where I was coming out of my bedroom. My oldest brother was on his knees in front of the TV sobbing as Kurt Loder. I just got goosebumps thinking about this as there's this helicopter shot over his house and Courtney Love's house in Seattle. And there's, the police are taping it off, whatever. And they're describing that he, shot himself and, brutal, man. So to answer your question, 90s grunge, absolutely. It was like my first favorite genre of music. And as my relationship with music has expanded, and certainly as I've gotten into music, like for me, this might sound like stupidly vague, but like good music is good music. I wouldn't describe myself as a country fan, but there's a bunch of country artists, and like people like Chris Stapleton to me is not exclusively a country artist. He has like rock and rockabilly and soul and like R&B and he's awesome. Like, so there's Zach Brown I feel similarly about too. So like, yeah. So I feel that way about many, many artists and many categories of music, even though I wouldn't say that like as a whole, I'm a country fan or I'm a rap fan or something like that. But there are exceptions across the board, because good music is good music.
Right. Yeah. I would say as a teenager, I was strictly metal. Mm. And then I got into, my parents raised me up country. And then I got into rock and metal like religiously, and then
That's an interesting transition. Like, how does that transition happen from country to that?
So, from birth till 13, maybe, or 14. Yep. I don't know when Metallica's Black Album came out, but
I think 92-ish.
Maybe yes, 12. Yeah. Okay, so birth till 12 years old, I was country. Dance, little Reba McEntire. Barbara Mandrell. I could name off a whole lot of some Oak Ridge Boys.
Sure.
Me and my sister was raised on country, right? And then when 12 years old hit, I heard on MTV, the great MTV back then, that Metallica came out with an album. That Metallica came out with an album called Black Album. And I'm like, oh my God, I got it. And I asked my mom that, and she got me the cassette. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, we remember cassettes.
Oh yeah, and, yeah, man. I had many. I had a Walkman. I had many cassettes. Yeah. Not even just of the. In fact, some of the my exposure to older music, like Rush, Genesis, Phil Collins, Aerosmith, Robert Palmer. I can think of so many artists before my time that I had cassettes of. That's how I got into that. Yeah, dude. I love that they did that, man. I thought that was really cool. And I like that there's an appetite for that. Like, I like that fans get on board with that. I think there's something cool about that.
It's slowly coming back, because a long time vinyl was like a big no-no, because CDs were in. And what's old is new again, because vinyl's coming back in the big, I don't have to say, I got tons back here and cassettes are here and there, sporadically. Yeah.
Sure.
But
on that Black Album, I vividly remember seeing the Enter Sandman video for the first time and be like, holy shit. And Metallica on that album is the first concert I ever went to. I was like 7, but I was with my best friend, and his parents took us to that. And it set the bar so high for like what? Because it was just, it's an arena show. It was huge, like pyro and like crazy screens and incredibly loud. And that had a huge, huge impact on me. I've been definitely a lifelong Metallica fan for sure.
Yeah, but when I found out about Metallica, I heard about Dave Mustaine, and I'm like, who is Megadeth? So, you know, it's snowball from there, man. And I was a really avid rock and metal fan for years until I branched out and listening to more music, you know, different kinds of music.
Did you have a preference, like, being, so I wasn't aware of the, like, because I didn't get into, like, music journalism until much later. I didn't give that much of a shit to, like, start reading interviews and history and stuff. So I didn't realize the connection of early Metallica days and then the Megadeth split off and everything. And but I was plenty aware of Megadeth and was listening to a lot of Megadeth. Did you have a preference between the two? Because they're not, like, Megadeth is decidedly a different band. Like, it is a different flavor of metal.
So, yes, I did. I was strictly a Metallica freak, you know, back when I was teenagers, you know. See, Kill 'Em All to Black Album was great. I loved Load. I didn't really like Reloading and just doing it all from there.
Yeah.
But now, if you ask me now, between the two, I would say Megadeth, because of consistency. You know, Metallica puts out every, 5-6 years?
Megadeth is prolific.
Every year to 2 years.
It's a lot of albums there.
And that's so great music, you know? I mean, I don't know how Dave does it, but he's coming out with bangers every album, you know?
I went to a Megadeth concert in many years ago with my oldest brother, and we were probably in our late 20s, and we were easily the youngest people there, which doesn't matter to me. In fact, I like when multi-generational people can like music. But Dave came out on stage, and right before the first song, he's like, "Doctor said I got carpal tunnel syndrome and can't play anymore, but check this out, motherfucker." It's like,
yeah.
I mean, he's just been grinding for literally, probably close to 40 years at this point. And like you said, way more prolific, touring all the time, putting out albums all the time. Yeah.
It seems
kind of monster, the Metallica documentary about making Saint Anger.
So I did not like the album when it came out. Now I have total respect for it now because I saw what they went through making it. And oh my God, I love that album now. You know, it's one of my albums, you know.
I still struggle to love the album, but the documentary is one of my favorite music documentaries of all time.
Right.
And I really like the scene where Lars sits down with Dave and they kind of like hash it out. And it's weird as someone who's like an aspiring, you know, I am a musician, but I aspire, you know, to much grander levels, to see Dave Mustaine sitting there, who by all metrics is an incredibly successful, if not legendary, musician at this point, and was a part of the biggest metal band of all time for a very critical time period. But he still has this resentment where he's like, Metallica fans fucking hate me. I've only sold 15 million. You've sold 500 million or whatever it is. And he lives with this. It's like he can't enjoy his own enormous success because it's not Metallica, which is very tragic to me. It's very sad to know that he has, for all intents and purposes, achieved a dream of, I mean, he has achieved what like 1/1,000,000% will ever achieve in the human experience, and it's still tainted by the fact that it's not Metallica. It's very unfortunate. I hope that came out 10-15 years ago. I hope he has evolved past that. I hope he doesn't feel that way anymore, because he's achieved absolute greatness.
To be kicked out of a band like that, bigger than anybody, and then make your own band and be a lot more, I wouldn't say more successful, but they're more successful in their own right. I mean, just says a lot about the dude, you know. I mean, he's great, you know.
For sure. And you're fighting against, you're not just like basically starting from scratch and achieving success. There was that feeling of Metallica fans being like, fuck you. Like, you're not anti-Metallica, so you're actually like, it's an uphill battle despite the fact that you're like super talented. And I have tons of respect for Dave and what he was able to achieve, and is still going very, very strong, and by many metrics has done much better than Metallica because of, like you said, the consistency and just how often they're putting out new music and good music. Still, like, me and my brother still like bust out new Megadeth albums. We're like, damn, this is sick.
Yeah, I think they're coming out, well, have they come out with a one out, because I know they're coming out with one in the near future, right? With the new guitarist. I don't know what his name is.
Yeah, because Kiko. Which is interesting. So I like that. This is actually kind of a good segue into getting about what I'm trying to do right now is that it's very encouraging for me to see someone like Kiko getting into Megadeth and Luke Holland, this phenomenal drummer who started with like basically a social media presence being the drummer for Falling in Reverse, is that I see myself on this path where it's unconventional, but there are these phenomenal musicians. And I'm not saying that I'm at Kiko's level, that he's a virtuoso, but there are these people out there who have built, have basically developed themselves, their career, their brand, whatever, as a solo artist. And with the advent of social media, that's created these opportunities for them to show their versatility and do collaborations with like what I'm doing with all these different bands. And the idea, my goal with this is to like make people aware of and, you know, love Fear of Water. But that is like a transition for me to go to the Kiko route, to go to the Luke Holland route. There's several other examples of this, of guys who have like proven themselves individually, which is in many respects much harder than being with like a group of four other super talented people and then having, you know, all the responsibilities and work and logistics split between those five people. And you know, achieving success in music as a whole, very difficult. Doing it by yourself is even more difficult. So it's very encouraging for me to see guys like Kiko and Luke kicking ass, rightfully deserved because they're so talented. But there's a lot more than talent that goes into becoming successful and having longevity in this industry. So I'm very encouraged by their path, and I'm following in their footsteps.
So before we talk more about your musical efforts here, when I grow up, I want to be like you, okay? And by that, I want to ask you about this picture that I found on your Facebook page.
My literal hero.
With Mr. Dave Grohl for the audio people listening in right now. Yeah. Could you tell me, I mean, like, where did this picture derive from? I mean,
happy to talk about it. Something that I also really like is that in the screen that you have up, you can also see in the comment section that I posted, I took pictures with my phone of photos I had developed when I was in high school of my childhood bedroom, which is a fucking mess, by the way, but showing that like, I literally have an entire, I'm 40. And since I've been nine, Dave Grohl has been a part of my musical journey. And you know, I loved Nirvana, and it took a while for me to be focused on Dave as part. I liked Nirvana as a whole, but then Dave became the standout thing. Like I said, I vividly remember Kurt's death being announced, and then pretty quickly Foo Fighters. So that first Foo Fighter album was made while Nirvana was still a thing. There you go, dude. Johnny on the spot, man. You got like all the shit ready to go.
That's what I did. Okay, so For years, I don't know if this is still true, but for years he told everyone he hates this album, and this is my favorite album ever from him. Is it yours? Is it your favorite, or do you have?
It is. Ooh, that's tough. So it's not it's not favorite, but it's incredibly important to me. Like,
yes.
I would love to hear that album re-recorded, and I know a lot of people cringe because it's like classic because of the way that it is, but like it's recording, whatever. It's just, it has a very garage sound to it that I love.
Yeah.
But just future Foo Fighter albums, even just the next one, The Color and the Shape is my favorite. It was this phenomenal evolution from the first one, and so many classics on it, but also like the deep cuts are amazing. There's still some of my favorite heavy Foo Fighter songs are also off of that album. And you know, Dave persevering through that, not only that loss, but like he immediately coming out of that was given so many I hate when this thumbs up emoji pops up out of nowhere. He was given this offer to become Tom Petty's drummer, and he did play with Tom Petty on SNL shortly after Kurt's death, and basically he said no to becoming the permanent drummer for one of the biggest rockers of all time and unbelievable amounts of money, like unbelievable money.
Right. Yeah.
And I have so much respect for him that he said, no, I'm going to start from scratch. And again, this is like pretty much pre-internet, let alone pre-social media, where, you know, it's not like he had a ton of visibility at that point to be like, what's up, fam? I'll start my own thing. Like, and subscribe here. Like that first album was literally on cassette tape being passed around to people in different like music groups. So like I love that at the point in time where he put the actual band together, He still, despite the fact being a multimillionaire at that point, he insisted that they do it in a van. No tour bus, no, like they're like, if we're going to fucking do this, this is how we bond as a band, and this is how we take this seriously, is that we don't start at the pinnacle just because I have a ton of money and I don't want to lean on the success of Nirvana. And there's still, to this day, so many people that are surprised to hear that Dave Grohl was the drummer of Nirvana. So anyways, for all of those reasons and so many more, he's been this enormous inspiration to me, especially as I learned early on that I had this incredible attraction to multiple instruments. And he was the first guy that I was really aware of, him and Trent Reznor, of guys that are like doing it, like make, not just like I can, but I am creating music as the one guy playing, writing all the parts, recording it, and then building a band around it. I found that very inspiring for me to basically decide to have an entire lifetime of honing my skill set around multiple instruments. And then past then, you know, just the longevity that he's had, the reputation that he has, his versatility of making documentary movies, becoming a best-selling author, all of his collaborations. Everything. He even like, have you heard the Grohl Sessions, Zach Brown EP, where, so he produced a 5-song EP for the Zach Brown Band called the Grohl Sessions, and it's phenomenal. So I just love the fact that he can like do all these different things. And dude, there used to be this show on MTV called Fanatic. You remember that?
Yeah.
So I made a VHS tape. I wish I had a copy of it, but I just like made a VHS tape and then mailed it into MTV, where basically, you know, they would MTV reviews all of these fan tapes, and then they like approach each of these bands. Like there was a Korn episode, and there was a Limp Bizkit album or episode, but they'd be like, hey, you know, all these fans sent in, we think this is your biggest fan, and then they like fly him out, and they get to hang out with the band, and then they play with them. And I remember being so upset that there was a Foo Fighters episode, and the girl that they picked, like they said, hey, you want to play a song with us? And of all of the songs she could have picked, she picked Big Me, which is their, still to this day, their most simplistic and straightforward song of all time. And she f***ed it up terribly. Sitting there, I mean, I'm a kid, I'm like seventh grade or something. Right. Like, this is bullshit. This should have been me, and I would have played, you know, Hey Johnny Park or whatever. I was like, I'm so much more legit as a fan. And anyways, so it's just, I've had this, they've been an enormous fan, not just Foo Fighters, but Dave Grohl as a man for my entire
life. I don't know if Big Me would be the song that I would pick. You know, it'd probably be something like For All the Cows or my hero is my all time.
It's a great song.
Like, dude.
For All the Cows, that's a great choice too, cows, man.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I do feel like one, so Foo Fighters is very consistent, but one thing I feel like they have gotten away from is being weird. And on those first two albums, there's a lot, especially the first album, there's just some weirdness, man, like some artistic quirkiness that I feel like has been a little lost as he's become the biggest rock star in the world. But I still love it. Still love all the albums. But anyway, so at Sonic Temple in Columbus, Ohio in 2022, I was there with my friends in Nothing More. And I knew that Foo Fighters were the headliner, but like at these big festivals, there's backstage and then there's like backstage where that's, so backstage is for all of the bands, and then premium backstage is premium, just for the headliner, like their own security, their own catering, their own entrance and exit to the venue. And that's very intentional. It's to like give them space and quiet and peace or whatever. But so I had no intention of actually, I knew I was going to be in the approximate same space as Dave Grohl at the same time, but I didn't think like maybe I'll sneak in there. But it just so happened that Matt Pinfield, it's been a very MTV centric conversation. Matt Pinfield was at the festival. He's hanging out backstage, and it was his birthday. And I'm like, so Dave came back to sing Matt a happy birthday. And that was great. And there's like film crews and stuff. And what's interesting, this might be TMI, but just an interesting story, is that something like with me at catering, and like while this was happening, my body told me, if you are not away from these people in 100 seconds, you're going to start vomiting on everyone. And I just like, I don't know what it was, but it's just something sat really wrong with me.
Like 8 or something.
Yeah, exactly. So I went over by the tour buses and I puked for like 15 minutes. I wasn't drunk, wasn't sick or whatever. It's just like, just something happened to my body. It's like, you have 2 minutes to get out of here. And I'm like, like Dave's there, right? I just missed my chance. Although I'm sure he got swarmed immediately.
Yeah.
And so I'm like all over there yakking, and I got a, you know, my composure together after like 15 minutes, went on the tour bus, brushed my teeth, changed my shirt, and got off. I was like, fuck, I blew my chance. And like, as I'm coming off the tour bus, Dave is like coming around the corner on his way back to the, like,
you're like, main. Dude.
And I was like, right. Yeah, I immediately was like, I'm sure, whatever. If I could talk sure to you for like a little bit of you, man. Yeah. he's like, yeah, man, what's up?
Right.
It was great, dude.
And I'm sure you know that he was asked to play with Gwar. But he didn't feel comfortable joining that band because he didn't want his mom to, you know, because of what Gwar does. For anybody who doesn't know, it's kind of risque. And I don't think he wanted his mom.
It's an understatement.
So, yeah. Right. Very much understatement. So
they like simulate abortions on stage and like cut people in half. Like it's wild.
I mean,
it's
fun. I mean, because I've met them, you know, I've seen them in a couple concerts, but they're
nice.
They're kind of gory, you know. That definitely take home to mom about.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. All right. Yeah. So I have three albums here that I wanted to run you by, and you can tell me if you have any feelings about it. Where were you when you heard this or seen this album? All right. So we're gonna talk about this Pantera.
Okay. Absolutely, this is an album, Cowboys from Hell, that I inherited from having older brothers.
Right.
Metal was much more of an acquired taste for me than, like, as soon as I heard like Offspring, Stone Temple Pilots, Tonic, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, the first time I heard any of those bands, I immediately was like, yep, I love this. I did not feel that way about Pantera. It took me a while to like get my head wrapped around, you know what, I think Cemetery Gates was my first, like, I think I needed just a little bit more melody to like get hooked into it. And after hearing Cemetery Gates and like those, the, you know, the verses are so cool, and that the main guitar solo is so like soaring and melodic, and I was like, okay, this is more of like the appetizer to being able to listen to like Walk. And and I think also as I started, yeah, I just think I evolved from like rock to metal. And even today, I still like Slipknot and I like Coldplay, you know, like I can very much so enjoy this spectrum. But early on in life, I was like, everything's rock music. I love rock music. I'm much more like, so Cowboys from Hell reminds me of childhood, but I don't have this like childhood fondness for it. Pantera absolutely evolved for me in my like young adulthood as something like, fuck, this is
and apparently they're gonna make a new record with their permanent members, like, wow, I'm not sure how to think about that, you know.
But I have feelings about that too,
right? Yeah. All right, so this is my favorite Misfits album, American Psycho. You might not share the same sentiment because I don't know if you—
Oh, that's great, man. I feel like you almost did research on me. So the very first band I was ever in was a Misfits cover band called the Pop-Tart Thieves. And yeah, man, we just played. And I didn't even know the Misfits. Like, I knew I was into like Goldfinger and Offspring and a few other bands were about as punk as I was getting at that point in time. And I made friends with some older kids, and the first band, the first show I ever played at the Globe East in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which doesn't exist anymore. I had to get permission from my mom to go. Like, it was great. So Misfits have a special place in my heart. I mean, it's interesting, like, even the way that you phrase this, because it's not so much the music itself. It's what that meant to me as an introduction to the first time collaborating with other musicians and learning and becoming comfortable with music I hadn't learned before and performing it live. Like, Misfits to me is my introduction into performing live music. And I still hear, you know, and then like just bringing it all together, like hearing Metallica do, you know, Die My Darling and shit like that. And even the original Misfits are headlining some festivals this year too. So it's interesting seeing all of this shit come full circle.
I still think that that they should have hired Mike Hideous after they released Michael Graves. I think Hideous fits him perfectly. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like a lot of people, a lot of purists, because this goes back to the thing as well. Yeah. A lot of people just feel like a band is what it is when it's formed or when you become aware of it for the first time, then any deviation from that is like, well, the band's over. And I get that feeling, but there's plenty of examples of that not being the case. I think people give most of a shit when it's about the singer, because I guess like instrumentalists are replaceable.
Yeah.
Although I think one of the most glaring examples of that not being the case is Avenged Sevenfold. You know, unfortunately after the Rev died, like unbelievable shift in their music. And it was so clear how much he as the drummer was contributing to the entire sound of that band. I feel like Dream Theater went through a very similar thing where it's like once Mike left,
I think he joined Avenged Sevenfold for a minute or two, right? Because he did one album with him or something.
Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah, which was really cool. So like the Rev's favorite drummer of all time was Mike Portnoy. All of the demos for the album Nightmare, I think it's called, were recorded. And then they reach out to Mike and be like, hey, you know, the Rev passed. He was, you know, yours idol. So I thought it was very, very cool for Portnoy to come out and record that album and tour with him on that. But that was the last album that the Rev's like fingerprint was on. And to me, it's very, very clear. I feel very similar about Seven Dust. There's three albums where Clint Lowry was not in Seven Dust. And to me, it's so night and day, those three albums. It's abundantly clear that Clint Lowry is a critical part of what makes Seven Dust Seven Dust. But anyways, I'm accepting of bands evolving and changing lineup, whatever. Sometimes it's done well, sometimes it's not.
The coin is flipped on Pantera. I'm not sure. I'm not, you know, but we'll see, you know, when they come out with their album. More or less album that I want to go through with you is the infamous Soundgarden.
Yes.
This is down on the upside. I had to look at it. Yeah.
Yes. So that's an interesting album for me because while I inherited a lot of music from my brothers, I feel like Soundgarden was my own discovery of sorts. And then, you know, I definitely started with their later stuff. Super Unknown was my intro, and that album is incredible. And
amazing.
What's interesting about Down on the Upside is that I have a love-hate relationship with it because I think it has the best singles on it and my least favorite non-singles. Like all of the songs that didn't make it to the radio, I'm like, I don't think that they're bad, but like it's very seldom that I will sit down and listen to that album front to back, as opposed to like Super Unknown, where I will absolutely do that. And then even I did actually just recently go back and listen. I'm a huge Chris Cornell fan, Audio Slave, his solo stuff, Temple of the Dog. I went back and listened to, and I'm going to blank on the name. It's called like King of Bones or something, but like the last album that Soundgarden did when they got back together. And it was just like, even though it's the exact same lineup, there was like the magic is just not there.
Right.
I don't know how to, I can't put my finger on it because Chris was still crushing it. Chris was still doing all of these other things. Like Audio Slave is incredible. Yeah. His solo stuff is amazing and versatile. I don't know what it was. It just, but anyways, that album to me was very much so. I think it also marks the like kind of end of grunge for me. I think it was like at that point, like Pearl Jam was going way more towards like a almost like indie rock kind of sound. And they've never really gone back to like Versus, Vitalogy 10.
I think it's
an important album.
Yeah, 10 was the best album I think that Pearl Jam ever released. And then of course, you got something probably with the Purple album, my favorite album of all time from there. But I think grunge just slowly became extinct in a way, you know.
So agreed. I think it's interesting that I've a lot of times when you look back at, like, to me, decades have very definitive musical genres. You know, like 70s had like what we call like classic rock now, but also there was like this huge like funk movement happening there. The 80s had like hair metal, but also new wave and like electro synth pop and industrial getting introduced. In the 90s, very much so like hip hop is becoming enormous. Grunge, obviously biggest thing on the planet. 2000s, I feel like the last definitive genre of music, although this is not good, is like boy bands. And then after that, it's like, it's been two decades since then. And it's just like, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't. Oh yeah. 2010s is blah. Which maybe there's something good about that. But like, to me, I just feel like everything's getting kind of muddled together. And then there's these constant desires. You have like a Greta Van Fleet come out and be like, we're just basically going to be Led Zeppelin in the 2000s. There's like a lot of that kind of stuff being like, it's going to be retro. I don't know. I kind of yearn for the days when I could look at a decade and be like, this is the origin of this music. And yeah, I just feel like we don't have that anymore, unfortunately.
Right. Well, I now want to talk about your drum ticks. Your drum tick for Nothing More, we said in the beginning.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. But I want to know what were the key responsibilities of a drum tick for the band, and how do you ensure the drummer's setup meets their performance requirements? Something they need that you can't really, you know.
Yeah, so I had never drum teched before. I'm a lifelong drummer, had a very seasoned touring veteran, certainly understand everything required of the drum tech, but I'd never done it before, and I wouldn't change anything, but going from never doing it before to my first gig is with one of my favorite bands of the last 20 years with a very complex setup. Like, Ben is very particular. I'm not him at all, just like,
no, yeah.
You know, there were like specific measurements about like cymbal height and angle, yeah, and tom placement and tuning notes. He has a very big kit, both acoustically and then many different electronic components, both like foot triggers and different pads throughout the entire kit. He also controls basically playback, so he has a drum pad to the left of him that has stuff like electronic snares and 808s and stuff like that, but he also like starts and stops the click essentially that the whole band is playing into, so like the backtracks are all synced up with it and everything. So like, you know, they'll finish a song and then Johnny will talk to the audience and Ben is kind of reading when is that little thing gonna wrap up so he can hit this pad, and the whole band gets this like 1, 2, 3, 4 and the next song starts. And then all of that is running through two computers that, so basically as drum tech for Nothing More, I'm in control. I'm responsible for this very big particular drum set and all of these electronics that run through these two computers. One is specific to what Ben is doing and all of his electronics. The other one is controlling all of the like vocal effects, and it's tied into the lighting. And like, so I basically went from no drum tech experience whatsoever to the entire show is dependent on what I'm doing on my very first tour. And it gave me an incredible amount of anxiety, especially because the tour that we did, so I was with them for basically all of 22, and then we did Shiprocked in 23. And then I stepped away to pursue basically Raw and Fear of Water more dominantly. Because I've had no desire to like be a drum tech. Like every night I'd be sitting there out of the stage watching music happen, and while I was proud to be like helping bring it to life, I was like, I'm 15 feet away from what I want so badly, which was cool, because at the end of that tour I ended up performing live with Nothing More. That meant a lot to me at the Machine Shop in Flint, Michigan. But yeah, man, it was Ben was a great guy to work with. He's very clear about what he wants. My biggest complaint of his is that he is a beast and he plays super fucking hard, and I've never seen someone go through so many cymbals. It would be in the middle of the set, and like, you can just, because he hits so hard, when you hit a cymbal that is definitively cracked, it's this very unique, weak sound. And so like, even finishing the song with that is kind of unacceptable. So like, for the whole set I was basically like, your cymbals ready to go. I got to the point where I was having to like go to Guitar Center in between like shows or whatever to like stock up on more cymbals. And he actually, to his credit, was able to like course correct. He, like, him and I sat at the kit and kind of figured out like, is it the angle of the cymbals? Is it the placement? Yeah. And I didn't, no one would ever ask him or any drummer to like play softer. It's like, you do what's right for the music. But we were able to course correct halfway through the tour, and he broke only like one cymbal for the next 25 shows, which was great. So it's cool to be able to evolve for that kind of reason, because he was in his comfort zone. And so to get out of that comfort zone and adjust to like what you have been playing at home and what you did in rehearsals, in for the name of like making the show go smoother and also not be spending $700 per show in cymbals. And he's a phenomenal drummer. I don't love that man.
So what? So was did he use Lildren or Paste or he has to really hit them hard to make them.
Yeah, you know. I'm blank. I'm almost positive it's Zildjian. Yeah, I'm like 90% sure right now. I don't know. And also, just him breaking them is no reflection of like the company.
No. Right. Yeah.
He literally is like
hard hit.
It's like domestic abuse on cymbals, dude. And huge sticks, and he's ripped. And it's just like, yeah, it's not like he's trying. That's just his style.
His way of play. Right. Yeah.
Dave Grohl famously beats the absolute out of his drum sets too. So yeah, I get it, man. I get it. But it was a good experience. I love those guys. Formed, you know, lifelong friendships out of that, both with the band and other members of the crew. Actually, the guitar tech is living with me right now. Yeah, man. Like, there was a really, really good experience. It was just a lot.
Yeah.
I strongly encourage everyone to get out of their comfort zone in a lot of ways in life. So many good things for me, certainly musically, but also just other things in life, has come from me making the conscious decision to do what makes me uncomfortable. And yeah, there's a chance that you'll fail, but like not doing something because you think you will fail, you're already experiencing 50% of the feeling that you would if you did try it and fail. So you might as well just try it. Like this fear of failure, you're still feeling that discomfort. So it's like, might as well try it. And then you could get the benefit of like, holy shit, I didn't think I could do it, and then I did. And there's all these positive things that come from it. Like, get out of your comfort zone, guys. Like, it definitely, a lot of good stuff comes from that.
When I look somebody up, I typically go through their Wikipedia page, which is somewhat 50% right and 50% you know, false, obviously, because they didn't like write it. But it doesn't say when you joined Raw. Is that in 2023 or
2021? Yeah, I went to, coming out of COVID quarantine, was very gripped with this carpe diem, life is short type feeling of, I've been doing music my whole life, but I was like, I really need to step it up now. Like, if I'm serious about this and want to this to really take off, I need to start working with serious producers and engineers to take, because I was self-recording basically up until that point. I was like, I need to get to the next level. At that time, Nothing More actually had just finished up recording vocals and doing some songwriting with Sahaj Tikitin of Raw, who's also a very prolific producer and has worked with like Star Set and Bad Wolves and otherwise, Motley Crue, like several other bands. And the guys in Nothing More were cool enough to make an intro for me. I sent some demos to Sahaj. Said, would you work with me? And he said, yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is that I came out there, we recorded in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is where he lives. And also Sweetwater is headquartered there. And we did a lot of recording at their phenomenal setup there. But on the first day of recording, he asked, like, what is Fear of Water and what do you want to do with this? And it's kind of what I explained to you at the beginning, that there isn't going to be like a band. There's not five of us. We're not going on the road. That this is basically my audio resume. And I want to make the best music with the best people possible, get on people's radar and just basically be top of mind the next time. I mean, you see prominent people leaving prominent bands all the time. It's like, I want to be in that Rolodex. And what's funny is that as I told him that, he's like, yeah, that's not how that works. I was like, okay, well, let's make some music. And at the end of 3 weeks of working together, he's like, do you want to be the drummer for Raw? I was like, absolutely. Did not go into that recording thinking like, this is a tryout for Raw, or maybe I'll sneak my not, that wasn't a thought for 1 second.
But just like having fun kind of session, right?
Yeah, exactly. I took it very seriously. Like, I wanted to work with a guy who's a good songwriter to help me make the best music possible. And so being in Raw is not like it's not even remotely close to a full-time gig. He's very kind of sporadic and selective about touring. He makes much more money working with other bands, and that keeps him at home with his wife and kids. So I totally understand that. But it's opened up a lot of doors. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity that Sahaj has afforded me. And yeah, so like, as I talk about, like, I want to be that, you know, go to the path of Kiko and Luke Holland. My mind, that's with a band that's much more like prolific and actively out there touring and has plans for recording and like maybe has label support. I'm looking to get into like a fully functional organization, you know, of a band, and that is doing this seriously for a living year round. And to me, Fear of Water, the brand of Fear of Water and that music and my social presence and the collaborations that I'm doing with these phenomenal musicians from these other bands and doing interviews like this, all of that is a part of this approach for me of getting to the point of the next time, whatever, Memphis Mayfire's guitarist quits or something. They're like, what about that Fear of Water guy? Like, that's my goal.
Fear of Water, dude. Let's get him in, you know?
Pretty much, man. Stranger things have happened.
So I don't know if this is going to make you excited or squeamish or something, but it seems to me like you have the ability to become another Nine Inch Nails, because Trestler does everything by himself too, right?
Yep. I mean that is really
what you want to, like, the end goal, the end game, I guess you would call it.
Except for the fact that I'm not like making Fear of Water an organization that like comes to life on stage and tour with that and everything. I'm much more focused on making the best music possible and releasing it for people's enjoyment. It's really for me, but if people enjoy it, that's awesome. It's like overwhelming for me to think about all of the work that would go into like building a band around this, creating the tour, getting a tour manager, the relationships with the venues, the merch people, the promotion, all of this stuff, is that compared to the lower hanging fruit of like joining forces with a band that's already doing this, that already has all these established relationships, that needs a very serious, very talented guitarist, bassist, drummer, you know, keyboard, whatever, that I could easily fill in and do that tomorrow. That being said, I could see Fear of Water. I will continue to do music as Fear of Water until I die. I could see much more me going this path that I've described of joining whatever, one of these incredible bands, any band that basically you hear on Octane right now. and that build momentum there, continue to build relationships, meet other musicians who are looking to do something new and different. And you know, maybe a couple of years from now, Fear of Water is materializes in a physical way that you see us/me on stage, and at that point, you know, it becomes more of the like Trent Reznor reality. But until then, I'm just really focused on making the best music possible and continuing. All of these songs for the foreseeable future are going to be collaborations with people that I really respect, which is cool. Like, it's a lot of work making those come to fruition, but it's been a really cool experience bringing those to life.
I think that you have more of a open relationship with more musicians now that you are by yourself. Because we're going to talk about this guy right here. It's Elias point, dude. Okay, absolutely. So I interviewed him a couple of years ago, and he's the most sweetheart of a dude.
He's one of the nicest people I've ever met.
Oh, yeah, by far. Could you tell us how that relationship connected and... Because you have a song called Codependent Parasites. And
that's correct.
It's like one of my favorite singles right now. Yeah.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah. I mean, it did really well, too. Like, it got, it's still getting radio play now. Honestly, the fact that anything that I do gets radio play is incredible to me. I'm confident in what I do. I believe in myself. I know that objectively I am a good musician. But like we were saying before about talent, like, that really is a moderately small part of the puzzle that leads to success in the music industry. Some of the most talented, like virtuoso, scary level talented people I know will never do anything with music for this enormous list of reasons and whatever. I mean, that's that's our different life journeys, but, but yeah, that song did really well. It's still getting radio play. It peaked at number 10 on the SMR top 50 list in February, which is incredible, because I literally have this framed because it's like...
And I think you said it was like 35, like this week, number 35 this week?
No, that's a different song. So that's one of my current singles, Systemic, featuring Aaron Nordstrom of Gemini Syndrome.
Great guy too, yeah.
Yeah, super nice guy. Yeah. Debuted last week and has shot up 26 spots to number 35. Chart comes out every Tuesday. So like that level of momentum is incredible to me, because Codependent Parasites with Elias climbed like two spots every single week for almost 4 months, getting up to the number 10 spot, which was exciting. And every Tuesday this chart comes out, and I was like, I'm going to open it up this week and I'm going to be gone, and I will be very happy even just being on it, like hitting 50 for, because every other band is like,
that's insane.
Metallica, Nickelback, Foo Fighters, Green Day, Blink 182, Seven Dust, Avenged Sevenfold, Atreyu, like it's the biggest,
all the
biggest and best bands in the world. And then this guy you've never heard of,
and then it's
out of Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
And it's even something that I had to like work through in therapy. Cause there was this, I have really severe, maybe not severe. I have very persistent imposter syndrome. And I think a lot of people go through this as well. But when you don't have like a sensory stimuli, whatever, some sort of life experience that counters the imposter syndrome, like if I went on tour and I'm selling out venues, I'm like, cool, this is a tangible physical metric of success that shows I shouldn't have imposter syndrome because people, right, the people who I'm seeing and hearing and meeting are enjoying the music. And, you know, I'm not doing that with Fear of Water. And I didn't even hear, like, Codependent Parasites was on the radio for 2 months on rock stations all over the country. And I'm getting these like spreadsheets being like, you know, Columbus and Raleigh and San Diego, but I don't live in those places. And it wasn't right. getting played in Austin. And I'm like, okay, I'll just take your word for it. Like, there's this chart and this spreadsheet and a royalty check. And I'm like, oh, sure. Okay.
Sure. Well, yeah.
But then it played on Octane, and it was like a huge, huge bucket list thing for me being played on, by many metrics, the best and biggest hard rock station in the world. And, you know, it being on this chart with all of these incredible artists, and like, I don't know, it's phenomenal, man. Like, to me, that's, that is a dream come true, and it really does validate like what I'm doing and this journey that I'm on. And Elias is a huge part of that. So been a Nonpoint fan forever. Like,
I remember
sitting in my 1997 Oldsmobile Achieva in my high school parking lot and playing Statement very, very loud on my sound system. And I grew up in outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nonpoint has this like very deep love for the capital city, Madison, Wisconsin, because the rock station there, 94.1 JJO, was the first radio station to really give Nonpoint a shot and like put their songs into rotation. And then they have music festivals there, Band Camp and Taste of Madison twice a year that they have played basically every single year for like 20 plus years. And so I've seen Nonpoint, I've lost track, 50, 60, 70 times.
I've only seen them one time with Pop Roach, but that was a great, because not a lot of people come to Columbia, South Carolina, you know, because I'm 20 minutes and not a lot of rock bands come down there. But when they do, I go, and when I heard Nonpoint, I'm like, I gotta go, dude. Come
there
on.
You go. Awesome, man. Awesome. Yeah.
Awesome friends,
I've just been a huge fan for a long time. And, you know, as I started, to me, going to Fort Wayne, Indiana to make music with Sahaj was this first domino that led to a lot of other things. Some of them are like direct introductions being made. Other things are like totally random. Like, hey, I'm just at the music festival at the same time as you. Or like, I put this song out, it does really well, and I have people reaching out to me. And so it was kind of a combination of random chaos and close friends of mine making introductions that led to me just like getting on a text thread with Elias. And with any of these collaborations, at the end of the day, for this first wave of collaborators, they've never heard of me. They don't owe me anything. They don't need to like do me a favor. And at the end of the day, their name is going to be attached to this piece of music potentially for the end of time. So the music really needs to stand on its own when I'm reaching out to this person being like, I envision you on this song, would you be down to do it? And they have created this awesome foundation for me moving forward. Now when I reach out to these other vocalists that I have the ball rolling with right now, now I can hold a quantifiable thing and be like, I've worked with these five incredible singers from these five bands, and you know, this music video has 200,000 views, and this was on Octane, and this hit number 10 on the charts, and like, they have given me something that I couldn't have fabricated by myself. And I'm incredibly appreciative of how they've assisted me in that way. But Elias was one of the first. He really believed in the song that I sent him. And he was a great collaborative partner. He, you know, contributed vocally, lyrically to it. He, you know, in a collaborative setting like this with a featured artist, sometimes they're like, give me an instruction manual, like give me the exact timestamp of like, okay, you're going to sing these lyrics in verse 2, which starts at 1 minute and 23 seconds and ends at 2 minutes and 10 seconds. Send me this vocal file, the end. And it could be as like clinical as that, as like, you tell me exactly what to do, I'm going to give you Elias went a very different route of like wanted to understand the origin of the song. And we talked about it creatively and the arrangement of it. He gave me like 55 different vocal takes. And like, here's three different versions of the main vocal and then doubled. And here's a lower octave and a higher octave and a third harmony and a fifth harmony. Here's it. Aggressive, you know, here's it everything soft,
like, okay. Yeah. Yeah, sounds like he was very surgical. Was very surgical when which is great, you know, because you need somebody like that to bring out the best in you, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So like being able to, in a lot of these scenarios, making music with people like Aaron and Clint Lowry and Elias and Heidi from Butcher Babies and Sahaj from Raw and these other collaborations I have in the works, like I'm working with some of my all time favorite musicians and making music that I like really put all of myself into and firmly believe in. So then to see it embraced by the community that I am a part of, you know, like I go on Shiprocked and like, these are my people. I'm not up on stage. I'm here to see bands just like everyone else. So to see those same people embracing and lifting it up and calling their local radio stations and adding these songs to their playlists and like interviewing me, whatever, like it means a ton to me. Like it really does, because I'm out here doing this by myself without a label and it's a lot of work and there's a lot of dead ends and red tape. And so it means a lot.
Yeah. So, I just want to go through a few more things and then I'll let you go. But I met Aaron Nordstrom back when he was the guitarist for OTEP. He is like the master at guitar, right?
He's awesome. So
with him and you working on Systemic, was he the same way that you work with Elias? Was he that surgical being too? Or what?
Even more. So he has a much deeper level of like theory understanding, like the actual technical specifics of music and chord structure and what key is this song in, and what kind of different variations and modes can we do this harmony in, where I just literally sit. I couldn't do it. If you put a gun to my head and said, play a E7 chord, I would be dead, because I don't have the knowledge. So same thing. I told him exactly, here's what I envision, but please, like, I would love the Aaron Nordstrom treatment. And he came back with like, he changed the entire key of the verse that he sang. And I would have never thought of that. And the first time I heard it, I was like, what the fuck, man?
Yeah.
And then I listened to it again. I was like, oh, this is perfect. Yeah. Right, like it was awesome. And it's been very collaborative. And I'm, you know, I feel very fortunate. I'm honored to call him a friend at this point and to be creative partners. I just did another collaboration with him in a different band that I make music with called Modern Echo. And I'm excited for people to hear that song as well. But he's a truly collaborative, well-rounded musical partner. Like, yes, he is in this iteration, he's a vocalist, but like he, like you said, like he understands guitar, he understands chord structure, he understands songwriting as a whole and how all the different instrumentation works together. And working with someone on that level really facilitates this opportunity to make a song as good as it can possibly be, instead of just being like, here's a song that you had nothing to do with, but it has that guy from that band, and so maybe their fans will like it. I'm happy with either, but you know, if any of my collaborators want to like really dig in, I wholeheartedly welcome it, being a democratically collaborative creative experience. It's awesome.
So I'm gonna say, who has a better scream voice? Okay. I'm going to go through three artists, and I want you to name the best one. Okay.
All right.
Heidi Shepherd, and why is like Heidi Shepherd? Man, she has the best scream voice ever made, and I just fell in love with Butcher Babies in the 90s.
Yeah.
And Carla's great too, but I don't think anybody can get that vocal range like she does.
Agree, she's which is why her contribution on my song One Day is incredible, because it's like this huge departure. She is a phenomenal singer. I mean, vocalist as a whole, including performer and stage presence and lyricist, like she's just an incredible human all around. But her involvement on my song One Day, which is more of like a ballad, will blow anyone away, just in terms of like, if you know her from Butcher Babies and then you hear her be like vulnerable and exposed but still like powerful and melodic on the song, is it really is a testament to her talent and her artistry. And she's a badass. And, there we go. Very very honored to have her on the track, and she's been super supportive of it since it's come out in terms of like the promotion of it and whatever. And but yeah, she's, to answer your question, let me I'm gonna say Heidi Shepherd is the answer to that question.
good response. So the song is about a bond between a mother and a son dealing with going through a abusive father.
So specifically it's about my relationship with my mother and her.
Okay, because that was my next question.
So, and I do think that it is the type. So it's about that. It's about my relationship with my mom.
Yeah.
Has got very accelerated and very, very powerful from trauma, essentially, which this happens with a lot of people in life. And my father is a incredibly abusive, violent, bad person, and she saved literally me and my brother's lives by physically removing us from that home with no backup plan. She just knew that like this is going to result in someone dying. And you know, we formed this incredibly strong bond. I have basically like two parents worth of relationships invested in one. And you know, we had this relationship of like mother and child, but also I was like, even at like 10 when this is really escalating, I had to grow up very quickly and, you know, experience some very adult concepts and have very adult conversations with her. And in my adult life, I very much so consider her a dear friend as well, which I'm all incredibly grateful for. But it also makes me fear her death tremendously. Like I've really, really struggled with what basically is called like anticipatory grief, that the inevitability of the fact that I am going to lose this incredibly important woman to me one day. And we all, many, this is a very common universal experience for most of us in the you know, the human journey, barring some sort of tragedy where we die before our parents, or maybe some people don't know their parents. But it is something that I've grappled with for a really long time, and writing this song has really been very cathartic and helped me focus more on like being appreciative and living in the moment and embracing the time that I have left with my mom. And Heidi really helped bring the emotional nature of that message out with her vocal performance. And I think a lot of people, certainly people who have survived domestic abuse, but also just people who love, and it doesn't have to be specific to your mom, but like, you know, that parental relationship can be incredibly powerful, and the universal inevitability of life coming to an end is, while it's incredibly common, it's also soul crushing. And it's a lot to work with. So yeah, I'm very, very proud of how that song came out. I'm very, very proud of the music video, which is, I did not envision doing this when I started writing the song, but it's like a modern ballet that I worked with this incredible choreography group out of Bulgaria called Emphis. And we sat down and listened to the song and went line by line. And they were incredibly creative collaborators and were amazing at translating constructive criticism and but also had their own interpretations of the lyrics. And I'm so happy with how that video came together, which everyone should watch. It's on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. That really, in a physical way, tells that journey that I've been on with my mom and that so many of us are with our parents, especially going through trauma. So yeah, I'm really, really proud of it.
No, awesome. I do have one more question for you, sir, if you don't mind. I promise that I'll let you go.
I'm not in a rush, man. Let's do it.
Oh, yeah. Great. Okay. So this might be the hardest question I've asked you tonight.
Ooh.
It's kind of rough, but I think you can give to handle it. An artist, album, or song that you can think of right now is there an artist, song, or album that you can listen to right now, but you can't tell me or Heidi or your mom or your other, how it makes you feel deep inside your soul? It's so powerful, you know?
So it's something that I have, like a song that I have like such an intimate connection with that I...
You can't tell how it makes you feel. You feel inside. Yeah.
There's two songs that there's two songs that I can think of, and I'm literally just going off of like what my brain is telling me, right? Yeah. Just like what, like getting a Rorschach test where they hold up the ink blot and they're like, what is this? You're not supposed to think about it. So just the two things that immediately came to mind is the song called Save Me by Muse. Muse is an incredible band, one of the best live bands I've ever seen. But this Save Me is one of these rare examples of the bass player taking vocal responsibilities and writing that song. And it's about, this is not what the song means to me, but it's about his near death battle with severe alcoholism. And there's just this true beauty to it that really resonates with me. And I kind of interpret it in my own way. And the other song is Slow Dancing in a Burning Room by John Mayer, where it's just like, yeah, there's just something about it, man. That it's
was that a cover song, or because I think Ernest did that too, right?
I believe it's an original. I'm gonna Google that right now. I'd be very surprised
if it was Ernest. Ernest, for anybody who doesn't know, it's a great country band, and they did that song. I didn't know that Mayer did it before. I don't know.
It does look like, yeah, songwriters. John Clayton Mayer. That being said, I do think the phrase "slow dancing in a burning room" is a phrase
Song. Yeah, it may be like.
Yeah, so like, actually, I'm curious. So, what is the artist that you're talking about?
Ernest, Ernest. It's a country band. Yeah, they got one called the exact same thing. So like I said, I'm not sure if it's the exact song, but. If it is
interesting, so it looks like theirs came out in 2023. I could be wrong.
Yes, I'm
looking at the lyrics now. Yes, so they are covering John Mayer. Yes.
Oh, okay, perfect. Yeah.
Because that song came out. Mayer song came out like 11 years ago.
Right.
It's gorgeous, man. It has incredible guitar work on it. The lyrics are a nice blend of like poetic. Literal, but not too literal. Poetic, but also,
yeah,
kind of biting and sarcastic. I don't know, man. It's gorgeous. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous song. And like I said, I'm just giving you the answer that's like immediately popping to my head. The two songs, I'm like, that's it.
Yeah. That's exactly what I wanted. You know,
cool. Yeah, man. Good. I'm looking forward to hearing Ernest's cover.
Oh, like, yeah, please.
Those are big shoes to fill, man. Those are big shoes.
Yeah. So, okay. So, for anybody listening right now, you can visit. Dave Perry, Fear of Water band on Instagram. It's Fear of Water, Instagram.com/Fear of Water. And then he's
also at Fear of Water on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. I have a Twitter account. I have a TikTok, but like I am concentrated on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube.
Facebook is Fear of Water band.
That's true. Yeah. But if you just search Fear of Water, like in the bar, instead of like typing into the URL, it'll come up.
You'll get it. So me and Dave are going to form a band. We're gonna get together and knock it out. Since you are so I was born in Austin, Texas.
Oh shit!
That's we are cowboys. I heard.
Hell yeah! I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Lived there for 30 years.
We're in Austin, so we're brothers. So we can form like a country metal band or something.
I don't know that that's been done or at least done well. So
we'll do it. We'll do it together. We honestly do thank you, Dave, for coming on the show, and I hope to God you work with Dave Grohl one day. That would be amazing if you do that. You know,
we'll see.
I'm gonna
manifest it.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll do an interview with you after our song
comes up. Yeah, perfect. So until next time, guys. Always remember, when words fail, music speaks. Bye, guys. Yes, we did it.
Oh, yeah, man. That was great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being so awesome to us and coming on.
My pleasure, man. Yeah. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah. And then...
Do you need me to do anything? I know that sometimes with StreamYard and Riverside, it needs like a few minutes to, on my end,
right,
to like render and upload. Do you need me to do anything?
You probably need to stay on for a little bit longer. I don't know. Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I did record it on my Rodecaster Pro.
Yeah.
You know, because
it does look like it's still, or I guess up here, it looks like it's still recording.
Yeah. Okay.
On your end. Let me end. So I don't know if that you stopping that begins the like